All right, good morning everyone. Boker Tov. Welcome to Sunday Shul here at SPL. This is the course, the Chronicles of the Apostles, and this is class number 93 in that course. And where we're at is last week we began looking at James, the brother of Jesus, not looking at his epistle. We've done that earlier in this course, but we're looking at him as a person and what we know of James from extra biblical sources. And so last week we primarily relied on Eusebius and his ecclesiastical history, as well as Hegesippus, an earlier church historian. This week we will continue to look with Eusebius and Hegesippus, but we will also look at what Josephus has to say. And there are some very interesting things Josephus offers, because Josephus has not only proved himself to be a very reliable first century historian, but he was a first century Jewish historian who was a Roman citizen, so he had a lot in common with Paul and how Paul kind of interacted in both worlds. But he also specifically, when he talks about James, he references Jesus, and what he says about Jesus is interesting. Josephus has also chronicled and talked about John the Baptist and who John the Baptist was, and so just a very good resource for us. Because part of the whole concept of the Chronicles of the Apostles course wasn't to study the book of Acts per se, but was to look at what did the very early, the first generation into the second and third generation Jesus movement, what did it look like? How did it function? How did it behave? How did it organize itself? What priorities did it set? Who were its leaders? How did they set a vision, a goal? How did they do strategy? And how did they plan to take this message of their Messiah to the world? And so last week we began looking at what we knew about James, and things we saw that were agreed upon in multiple sources, including Josephus. So again, not just biased Christian history, if you will, but also from Josephus and some other sources, is that he was very well respected in the Jewish community, even among the Jewish individuals who did not believe or follow Jesus, that James still had a very high standing. He was granted access to certain parts of the Temple Mount that others outside of the priesthood were not allowed into. And he also kind of began functioning as almost a rival to the Sanhedrin, that James and the Jesus community Sanhedrin were kind of becoming competition, if you will, and obviously that did not sit well, and that's what Josephus is going to talk about today. And when there becomes a change in the priesthood, things turn out very negatively for James. We probably won't finish everything with James even this week, so next week was when we'll probably finish up with looking at the person of James, because there's just a lot of information there. But let's get started with the blessing. Baruch Ata Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam, Asher Kidishanu B'Mitzvotav V'Sivanu La'Asoch B'Divrei Hadavar. Blessed Lord, since you have caused all holy scriptures to be written for our learning, grant that we would so hear them, read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest them, so that by patience and comfort of your holy word, we would embrace and ever hold fast the blessed hope of everlasting life. And we pray these things through Jesus Christ, your Son, our Lord, who lives and reigns with you in the Holy Spirit, one God, now and forever. Amen. All right, so last week we wrapped it up looking again at James being popular among the people, including as Hegesippus broke up the Jewish people of the first century. He looked at seven different sects, and Eusebius then notes that James actually had a good relationship with all of them, and that even the Sadducees and even the Jewish Epicureans, that is the atheistic Jews, that they were even coming to faith in Messiah. And so that began to cause the radar to kind of go up a little more. And so that's where we left it last week. And so we pick it up this week looking at another quote from Eusebius and his ecclesiastical history. Again, on the heels of Eusebius talking about James having a very positive relationship across the board with all types of Jews from all types of backgrounds, again, never fall under the impression that there was one type of Judaism in the first century. There was not one type of Judaism any more than there's one type of Christianity today. But Eusebius and Hegesippus tell us that James was able to have good relations with all of them for various reasons, and that in all of them, because of that, many were coming to faith that Jesus was indeed the Messiah. So with that, Eusebius continues and says, "Therefore, when many even of the rulers believed," that would mainly be the Sadducees and the high priests is what that's implying, those in the high priest class, "there was a commotion among the Judeans and the scholars and the Pharisees," kind of, again, among the elite, "who said there was danger that the whole people would be looking for Jesus as the Messiah." So some angst about James and the Jesus movement came to a new crescendo. For a while, it had kind of died down, and then it got revved up after over a decade of kind of being calm when Paul went up onto the Temple Mount, we talked about in Acts, at the end of the 50s, around 57 AD, and it kind of brought it all back. And then kind of was coming back down, and now that James is kind of having this inroad with a lot of individuals, it's kind of coming back up. When several leaders and prominent rulers openly cast their allegiance with Jesus and the movement, the Sadducees feared that the mass popularity enjoyed by James would not only remove any kind of public stigma that may be attached to the Jesus movement, but also, again, that James might have a position of authority, very high ranking. So prominent people no longer felt, were no longer feeling reluctant to identify with the Jesus movement. And so Sadducees like Ananias and Annas, the son of Annas, that we'll talk about in a little bit, via Josephus, tried to bring their concerns to the Sanhedrin. When they voiced their concerns, they said there's a danger for the whole people might be looking for Jesus as the Messiah. And they tried to convince the Sanhedrin to take direct action against the believers. But the Pharisees objected. And so this is when we go back to what we learned when we were in the book of Acts and even with Paul. When Paul, whenever he was brought up before trial, or brought up to hear why there was such a commotion, Paul never said he was on trial because of his belief that Jesus is the Messiah. And we saw that almost every single time Paul encountered the Jewish community had a favorable response to Paul. What did Paul always say was the reason why he was on trial and the reason why he was causing such a hubbubaloo? The resurrection, right? Not about Jesus, not just about Jesus, right? But the resurrection in general. Because the Sadducees, and as we learned last week, even a couple of other sects of Judaism in the first century did not believe in any kind of resurrection for anybody, period. All right, and so that was a major, major issue, the resurrection. And so obviously for the Jesus community, the resurrection is kind of a big deal, right? And so this idea that the teaching, the theology, the concept of resurrection could become the dominant ideology of the Jerusalem Jewish community had them unnerved, all right? And so they bring it to the Sanhedrin. And obviously the Pharisees on the Sanhedrin, as well as the Pharisees in Jerusalem, object to that because the Pharisees believe in a resurrection. In the days of the high priest Ishmael, the son of Phabi, and the Nasi, Simon, the son of Gamaliel, they controlled the Sanhedrin, and they were Pharisees. So even though it's kind of like, in today's world, if you have a Republican president, but maybe you have a Democratic-controlled Senate and House, right? Or vice versa, or some interplay of that, where no one has a clear control, even though someone may have the majority, but because someone has a certain leadership in the other party, it holds it at check. So the Sanhedrin was dominated by the Sadducees. The high priesthood and the priestly class was dominated by the Sadducees. But at this particular time, the high priest and the leader of the Sanhedrin were Pharisees, including one of them being the son of Gamaliel, the son of Paul's teacher. Okay, and so they really weren't interested in going after the Jesus community because they themselves believed in the resurrection and they weren't going to be a part of attacking that. And so long as the Pharisees had both of these positions, the high priest and the Nasi of the Sanhedrin, the Sadducees and the opponents of the Jesus community had no real hope of passing any kind of legislation with teeth that would stifle James or the Jesus community. But it did lead to a bit of a ruckus on party lines. Hegesippus says, quote, "There was a commotion, and not long after that, a series of events tipped the balance." So right now we're about to experience a tip in the balance, like an election year, if you will. So when there's two Pharisees kind of holding the veto power, things are kind of okay for the Jesus community, and they're okay for James. But soon and very soon, that shifts. And when that shifts, they take advantage of that. King Agrippa II had built a new story atop his palace in Jerusalem. And from that view, he was able to look down while reclining at table. And I want you to imagine a Roman leader, how they might enjoy leisurely lounging around on their rooftop, all right? Probably not the stuff that you would want in your worship service. And yet he built his new story on the palace in Jerusalem so that as he was lounging and doing the things a lounging Roman ruler does, he could look down and see everything happening there, but they could also look up and see that and hear everything. All right, and so you got to know that isn't going to go over well with the religious leadership. So the high priest, Ishmael, the son of Phabi, a Pharisee, didn't like the idea of Agrippa and Bernice. We've talked about lovely Bernice many times. They didn't like the idea of them kind of spying on them and looking in, and they really didn't like overhearing their parties while they were trying to make sacrifices and worship as they sipped drinks and entertained their guests. So Ishmael orders the immediate construction of a wall to block Agrippa's view. Okay? Agrippa commanded the high priest to take down the wall, and he refuses. The king complained to the procurator, Festus. Remember Festus from Acts? All right. So you had Agrippa kind of in this little region, but Festus over the larger region. So he goes to Festus and says, Festus, priest has built a wall. I don't want the wall built. I told him to take it down. He's disobeying me. I want you to do something about it. So Festus, as a Roman leader, backs up Agrippa's authority, and he orders the wall removed. But of course, the high priest Ishmael refuses. So Festus has Ishmael arrested, as well as several other high-ranking members of the priesthood for defying Roman orders. Like Paul of Tarsus, Ishmael, the son of Phabi, appealed to Rome. He was not only the high priest, but he also had Roman citizenship. So he did like Paul. Oh, you're going to arrest me? Well, I'm a Roman citizen. You can't treat me that way. I appeal to Caesar, and I want to go to Rome, just like what Paul said. However, things turned out differently for Ishmael, because he made it to Rome. He made it to Rome without the shipwreck and all the things that Paul did. And his case was, in fact, heard by none other than the Caesar, Nero. Right? So he actually got his case to come before Nero. Now, how do you think it went over? What do you think, before I tell you, what do you think Nero ruled? Might be inclined to think he sided with Festus and Agrippa, right? Roman, two Roman rulers of the region, like a kind of a mayor and a governor, and now you've gone to the president. You would think he would side with them. But we've spent some time looking at Nero, and what did we learn about Nero? He really doesn't follow logic, and he really doesn't care about it. In fact, he has almost a spiteful anti-Rome attitude himself. And so, to everyone's surprise, Nero overturns the demolition order. He finds in favor of the high priest, okay? Even though he's proven himself to be anti-Semitic and all of that, he sides with the Jewish high priest. The new wall in the temple was going to stay, and it had Caesar Nero's order that it was to stay. But neither the king nor Festus expected Nero to contradict their authority, and they weren't going to be satisfied with it. Perhaps to console Agrippa, Nero detained the high priest, Ishmael, and his colleagues as kind of court hostages in Rome. And as soon as the King Agrippa heard about the decision and that Ishmael had been detained, he decided he would appoint a new high priest for the good of the Jewish people. It's not good for the Jewish people to be without a high priest. And now we're in the era, which is what Jesus had against the priesthood at his time. It's what the Essenes of the time had against the priesthood. They were no longer picking their priest according to what the Torah said, that they were descendants of Aaron and the sons of Aaron and fit all of the qualifications that were outlined in the Torah, but that Rome selected the high priest, including them being from Levi and all that, really didn't matter to Rome, because what was that to Rome? But to make it look good, Agrippa and Festus say, look, you need a high priest, right? So we're going to appoint a high priest while Ishmael is away. You know, if he gets back, when he gets back, we'll get it all straightened out. But you really need someone in the meantime. So they replaced Ishmael with a new high priest by the name of Joseph, the son of Simon. Okay? So this is the first kind of turn that's going to go against the way of James and the Jesus movement. So from Josephus and his antiquities, Festus dies. When Caesar heard about the death of Festus, he sent Albinus into Judea as procurator. The king, Agrippa II, removed Joseph from the high priest. He had just put him there, but he removed him, and gave that dignity to the son of Annas, who was also himself called Annas. Which, by the way, in Judaism, if you meet someone who's named after a living relative, particularly a parent, you automatically know something's not right. They don't name their babies after living relatives. They may name them after in an honor of those who passed on, but the father Annas is still around. And so the fact that you have Annas ben Annas, Annas the son of Annas, already lets you know this family is not kosher, all right? The name alone betrays it. But nonetheless, his real name is Canaan bin Canaan. I don't know why Canaan becomes, but it becomes Annas in English. So this new high priest, Joseph, doesn't hold his office long. He holds it less than a month, because Festus died suddenly and unexpectedly, leaving his position empty. He had governed Judea at that point for a little more than 2 years, but unlike his predecessors and his successors, he tried to conduct a fairly fair and impartial kind of administration, at least as much as you do in the Roman Empire. The Romans immediately dispatched the message to Caesar. That would have taken several weeks. When news arrived, Nero appointed Albinus to take the empty post. But several months would pass before Albinus could arrive in Judea. Until Albinus arrived, the governorship remained empty. So there is a leadership vacuum. Now, bad things happen when there's a leadership vacuum. Just period. That's just kind of a lesson in life. When there's a leadership vacuum, other things decide to fill that space. All right? Or lots of people decide to try to fill that space or try things. And so there's a leadership vacuum for a while. This is where the Sadducees and the opponents of James and the Jesus movement saw the opportunity to kind of fill in that temporary power vacuum. So they prevailed upon King Agrippa II to appoint Hanan ben Hanan, or Annas the son of Annas, to the high priesthood. This no doubt would have been accompanied by some kind of bribe. Agrippa would have accepted the bribe, and he then removed the high priest that he had just appointed a few weeks earlier. Joseph stepped down, and Annas the son of Annas, Hanan ben Hanan, took his place. So Josephus continues. Annas, who was also himself called Annas the Younger, who, as we have told you already, took the high priesthood. He was a bold man in his temper and extremely insolent. He was also from the sect of the Sadducees, who are very harsh in judging offenders, much more harsh than the rest of the Jewish parties, as we have already observed. So here in the vacuum now, you had two Pharisees kind of holding things in check. One is now gone, and a Sadducee has been replaced up there, right? Because Annas is a Sadducee. So now the high priesthood is back in control of the Sadducees. Annas the Younger, the youngest son of Annas ben Seth. Annas ben Seth was the very same Annas that was behind the crucifixion of Jesus with Rome. Five sons of Annas ben Seth occupied the office of high priest during the first century. Five. Josephus records this in his Antiquities. Here's the quote. The story has it that this elder Annas was a most fortunate man, for he had five sons who all performed the office of high priest to God. And he himself had also enjoyed the dignity much earlier. Something like this had never happened to any other of our high priests. And not just five sons, but a son-in-law known as Caiaphas. Right? So you've got essentially, and Annas was always the person behind it anyways. No matter which son it was or Caiaphas, it was really Annas behind that priesthood. So you basically now have back in the head of the Sanhedrin, or the high priest, the same leadership that was in place when Jesus was on trial. All right? So Annas the Younger inherited his father's vendetta against the disciples of Jesus, but he lacked his father's subtlety and his political savvy. Annas the Older was a very savvy individual. The younger one had a reputation for being ruthless. He acted brashly, even more so than his brother-in-law, Caiaphas. Josephus observes that he was, though, a leading person among the Sadducees, and notes that the Sadducees were more notorious for their harsh judgments and punishments than the other sects of Judaism. Annas took that even a step further, and he hijacks the Sanhedrin. So then Josephus continues, therefore, because Annas had this type of personality, and he still had his dad really controlling the puppet, he took advantage of the opportunity. Festus was now dead. Albinus was still on the way. Annas assembled the Sanhedrin of judges, and he brought before them the brother of Jesus, who was called the Messiah. Now notice, this is a non-believing first century Jewish historian. And what does he tell you about James's brother? That he was named Jesus and that he was called the Messiah. Okay? Whose name was James and some of his companions. So Annas does what his father Annas had done. He convenes an illegal Sanhedrin. That's not the full Sanhedrin. It doesn't follow the protocol for convening a Sanhedrin, but has kind of this kind of make-do kind of version in order to bring forth James and convict him, just like they did with Jesus. So something we've seen in the Chronicles of the Apostles course is that when Jesus taught, it's enough for the student to be like his master. He literally meant that. And what you see in the first generation after Jesus, especially like through the book of Acts, is essentially everything you saw in the life of Jesus repeated, but in the life of his followers. And so we've seen where like Peter and John and Paul, they often did the same miracles Jesus did or encountered similar situations or trials that Jesus did. That's not accidental. And here you have James, Jesus' brother, who's taken the throne of the Davidic dynasty, undergoing a very similar trial that Jesus underwent. Annas took advantage of this absence of Roman authority, this power vacuum. Again, when the leader is not leading or when there's no leader, other people who have no business leading end up leading. Right? That's the problem. So no Roman authority, no authority. So the Sadducees found a way to get their way in there. Using this authority as high priest, he orders James, the brother of Jesus, arrested, as well as several other prominent members of the Jesus movement. The arrest comes shortly before Passover, just like with Jesus. Then he assembled the Sanhedrin, but it was a Sanhedrin of his own choosing, carefully eliminating the Pharisees or anyone who might have a pro-resurrection kind of sentiment. He brought James and his companions to stand trial, probably in the same court of the house of Caiaphas that condemned Jesus. So Josephus continues. When he had formed an accusation against them as breakers of the Torah, he delivered them to be stoned. So Josephus lets us know that Annas, the younger, accused James of being a breaker of the Torah. Josephus reports that the Pharisees were the most fair-minded of the citizens, and those who were the most careful not to break any laws, they were not present for this particular trial. James, the one called the righteous, he was called, as we talked about, Tzaddik. That's a very technical term that very few people in history have earned in the Jewish world. And we learned last week that James had that title not just among the Jesus community, but that he was known, including by Josephus and others in the Jewish community that didn't believe in Jesus, as the Tzaddik, as the righteous one. You only get that term if you are not just Torah observant, but if you are scrupulous, meticulous, above reproach, keeper of the Torah supreme, right? And so the idea that James the Tzaddik is on trial for breaking the Torah is kind of absurd. Even the book of Acts describes James and the Jesus community in Jerusalem as being, quote, zealous for the Torah. But Annas needed to make the allegation because only a serious breach of Torah could justify a death penalty. The Torah prescribes the death penalty for violation of the Sabbath, for adultery, for assaulting or cursing your parents, for occultism, kidnapping, murder, certain types of sexual immorality, defiling either the tabernacle or eventually the temple, idolatry, or introducing others to idolatry and blasphemy. Annas decided he would pin his hopes on the charge of blasphemy, which is the exact charge that they hope to pin on Jesus. In the days of the first century Jewish world, the word blasphemy had a broad range of meaning. It could mean abusive language, railing on someone, slander. But in a formal charge in a Jewish court of law in the fourth century, blasphemy was very specific. It meant that you deliberately defamed God, and more so, you defamed God by specifically making use of the divine name. And by divine name, I really mean divine names. That you were using God's name to create, to have power, to effect change. That you were pronouncing God's name. That you were teaching others to pronounce God's name. But it all revolved around the name of God. Okay? That was what blasphemy was. The Gospels make it clear that Jesus and his disciples, though, used the evasive synonyms for the name of God, one of them being heaven. If you pay attention to the Gospels, when it talks about heaven, you really can substitute God. The disciples were using circumlocutions, and they did it in several other places. The Sadducees, though, seem to define blasphemy as any statement about God that they deem diminishing. Because again, that was the difference Josephus noted between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. The Sadducees, while they're much more harsh in dishing out the punishment, were very much more lenient on what's admissible and so forth. And the Pharisees, who were much more full of mercy and compassionate, were also much more rigid in what they would allow in as evidence in a court of law and so forth. And so they don't have as high a standard. The court is convened by Annas, just like the court was convened by Caiaphas on the charge of blasphemy. For Jesus, Matthew 26, verse 64, when Jesus said, "You will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power," that's a circumlocution, not using God's name, "and coming on the clouds of heaven." The Sanhedrin also condemned Stephen, the first martyr of the Jesus movement, on the same charge. So this is like the charge they like to use. Okay, we go back to Eusebius. "Coming therefore in one group to James, they said, 'We adjure you.'" That's important language we'll talk about when they say, "We adjure you." That's actually a quote from the Torah. "We adjure you, restrain the people, for they have gone astray in regard to Jesus as if he was the Messiah. We adjure you to persuade all these that have come to the feast of Passover concerning Jesus. For we are confident in you and testify, as so all the people, that you are righteous, you are the Tzaddik. You do not show partiality. You must persuade the multitude not to go astray concerning Jesus. For all the people trust in you, as we do also." All right. And so that also has some similar rings to the trial of Jesus, where there was some false flattery going on. But what they're basically asking James to do is this: you're going to die, buddy, unless you tell all the people, you know, that they've misunderstood you, they don't really need to follow after Jesus as Messiah. You need to get up and set the record straight. And so there you can kind of think about when you see those videos of hostages, right, who are in front of a camera and they're like, "We hate the United States of America. The government is so corrupt. The people here that are holding us are treating us like we're royalty, and we've really come to love them and love their ways and their ideology." And the whole time they're saying that, you're thinking, yeah, I'm sure you said all this voluntarily, right? You know they're being forced to do that in order to stay alive. And so the Sanhedrin tried to cut this deal with James. "Hey, get up, set the record straight, and everything will be fine. Because after all, people trust you, respect you. You're James the righteous, after all. And, you know, they're going to respect you just like we really respect you." So the Sadducees did not ask James to testify before the court. They wanted something more public. They knew his popularity with the multitudes could incite a riot if they put him to death, but the high priest was willing to take somewhat of a risk. He argued that the execution be as public as possible. He wanted to strike fear into everyone's heart, but at the same time, they thought maybe before that we could use James's popularity to our advantage. If they could force him to publicly recant his messianic faith in the risen Jesus, they might strike an even deeper blow to not only the Jesus movement, but to those who hold to the resurrection. So it was Passover in the year 62 that's about to begin. Crowds of pilgrims arriving in Jerusalem from all over the corners of the diaspora. In addition, God-fearing Gentiles who revere Jesus are attending the festival. The Sadducees warned James that he needed to cooperate with them, and they prevailed upon him to refrain the people who had strayed after Jesus and believed in him as Messiah. The implication was clear. James knew if he didn't cooperate, they would certainly condemn him to death. The Torah describes stoning as the punishment for blasphemy, James did not have the option of remaining silent. The priest charged James under oath and said, "We adjure you." The Mishnah states, if a judge says, "I adjure you," you have been imposed and you are bound by oath and by the use of the divine name or divine attributes to be obligated to testify. It's also from Leviticus chapter 5, verse 1. If a person sins after he hears a public adjuration, the words, "I adjure you," he must testify as a witness to what he has seen or otherwise known. If he does not tell it, then he bears the guilt. Okay, so that was a very official statement, "I adjure you." And so there, Eusebius is probably being quite accurate. He's recounting very specific legalese straight from the Mishnah as well as from the Torah. So, this is what they do. They tell James, "Stand on the pinnacle of the temple, where you will be clearly seen and your words will be heard by all the people." I read that whole Jesus got accused of being blasphemy because when he said, "You will see the Son of Man," and so forth, for a specific reason. It has to do with that pinnacle. "For all the tribes with the Gentiles also have come together on account of the Passover." So they basically told James, if he wanted to save his life, he needed to stand on the pinnacle of the temple on the day of Passover Eve and recant his faith in Jesus. On that day, the anniversary of his brother's execution, thousands of Jews filled the roads ascending the Temple Mount. James was to take a position high up on the portico on the southeast corner of the Temple Mount. What's fascinating is, though it no longer stands, obviously, because the Romans destroyed it, below on the southeast corner of the Temple Mount, they have uncovered the first century pinnacle of the Temple Mount, where the crier would let everyone know prayer has started, a new moon has begun, a new month has begun, the Sabbath has started. It was because of the layout of the land and the valley below it and the roads, it was the place where everyone could see you and everyone could hear you. Right, it would be where the shofar would be blown from and so forth. James was to go to this spot where the temple crier would stand each morning, where the rooster would crow and let you know the morning sacrifices had begun. The top of the royal portico that Herod the Great had built. Again, it's on the southeast corner, looking down to the Kidron Valley right below it. Josephus describes this place like this in his Antiquities. "And this portico is more worthy of description than any other under the sun." Josephus apparently really liked this pinnacle. "Although the valley was extremely deep, so that if one looked down into the depth from on top," meaning the Temple Mount, "its bottom could not be seen. The vastly higher elevation of the portico stood upon that height. If anyone looked down those combined heights into the valley from the top of the roof, he would feel dizzy, and he could not see to the bottom of such great depth." More than 30 years earlier, this is where the Satan had brought Jesus and tempted him to invoke divine intervention and heavenly protection. "Jump from this pinnacle so that everyone can see you. If you're the Son of God and you really want people to know you're the Son of God, look, get up here. Everyone will stare at you. They'll be like, 'Oh my goodness, he's going to jump.' People will crowd around. You jump. The angels come and save your life. Everyone knows it's a miracle. They'll believe you. And guess what? Then you don't have to go the way of the cross. You don't have to go the way of suffering. You don't have to go the difficult path. You don't have to go the way of rejection. You can just short circuit that whole passion thing. Just jump off of this pinnacle," right? That place is where James is standing. And they've brought James up there thinking, for some reason, James is actually going to do this. Okay? But Satan says, hey, to Jesus, if you're the Son of God, invoking Psalm 91, jump down, and his angels who have been given charge over you will protect you. So at the pinnacle, Eusebius says, "Thus the aforementioned scribes and Pharisees placed James upon the pinnacle of the temple," that would be the Sanhedrin, "and cried out to him and said, 'Zadok, righteous one, in whose word we should all trust. Tell us, what is the Sha'arei Yeshua? What's the way of salvation? For the people have been led astray after Jesus, the crucified one. So they have him up there and they're like, oh, James, the righteous one, the one everyone respects, tell us where salvation comes from. What's the gate of salvation? Because people are thinking it's Jesus, and people think you think it's Jesus. And he answered with a loud voice, why do you ask me concerning Jesus, the Son of Man? He himself sits in heaven at the right hand of the great power. This is the very quote Jesus used to get himself killed. At the hand of the great power, and is about to come upon the clouds of heaven. So, that didn't work out for Annas the younger. Again, he's not as smooth as his father. James lifts up his voice, but instead of recanting, he gives testimony. And he gives testimony to the crucified one, the Son of Man, the one at the right hand of God. He said, he himself sits in the heaven at the great right hand of the great power and is about to come in the clouds of heaven. Jesus in Mark 14:62, you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power, coming with the clouds of heaven. As Jesus had done when testifying before Caiaphas, James uses the same circumlocution for God's name with great power. And he alludes to two important messianic prophecies. Psalm 110, the Lord says to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. And Daniel 7:13, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a Son of Man was coming. And he came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. With his testimony, James confirms his belief in Jesus as the Messiah, that he's risen from the dead, and that he shares authority with God the Father, and that he would come again. So, how does this end for James? Eusebius. These same scribes and Pharisees said again to one another, we've made a mistake in allowing such testimony to Jesus. Like, they're looking probably at Annas going, you're an idiot. Why did you do this? Let us go up and throw him down in order to dissuade them from believing in him. And they cried out, oh, the Zadok has also erred. Okay, so they say, look, we're going to have to go up there and chunk him off the temple mount. Okay? And they do, all right? And Josephus, by the way, probably get to that next week. Josephus validates this exact story, okay? The Sadducees realize their mistake. Rather than dissuading the multitudes from faith in Jesus, they've only fanned the flames of that. They quickly confer and agree that James has committed blasphemy up there, the same way Stephen did, the same way Jesus did, and that he must be executed, i.e. he must be thrown down. Which fits in some ways with the Torah protocol for stoning. How you were stoned, according to the Torah, was first you were pushed off a cliff, and then they would drop a gigantic boulder on your chest if you survived the push off the cliff, and then everyone in the town had to come and chunk a rock at you, right? And meaning, if everyone wasn't willing to participate in killing you, then you didn't have the death penalty. Okay, that's why it was rarely carried out. Because you may think you want the death penalty for someone, but you're probably gonna chicken out if they gave you the needle and said, well, poke him in the arm. Chances are you would not even touch the needle. And if you did, you'd probably drop it and not want anything to do with it. All right, and that was intentional. That's the way the Torah built the system. So the idea was blaspheme, let's push him off. That's pushing him off the cliff. And as Josephus describes it and so forth, he shouldn't survive that. But let's see what happens. So they went up and threw down the righteous one. And they said to each other, let us stone James the righteous. And they began to stone him because he was not killed by the fall. He didn't die. The Mishnah carefully describes how the Sanhedrin should conduct a stoning, but the Sadducees did not follow the Pharisaic protocol. Josephus commented on the death of James by saying the Sadducees are very harsh in judging offenders, more harsh than the rest. But James's death generally conforms to the method of stoning described in the Mishnah. Prior to the stoning, a herald had to announce the name of the person. Notice they say, James the righteous one. Then, after announcing the person and the verdict, the story told by Hegesippus includes those announcements. The Mishnah says they must push the victim from a precipice. And we see that James is thrown down from, as Josephus says, the dizzying height of the temple pinnacle. The disciples of Jesus saw James drop from the height, and they connected it with the words of the Hallel. You may remember last week we saw where the Jesus community began to see James fulfilling prophecies just like Jesus did. And because he was called James the Righteous One, the Tzaddik, everywhere the prophets spoke about the Tzaddik or the Righteous One or righteousness, they substituted James's name. Okay? So, during Passover, the Hallel, a series of psalms, is said quite a bit. You pushed me violently so that I was falling, but the Lord helped me. The Lord is my strength and song. He has become my salvation. The stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone, the pinnacle. This is the Lord's doing, marvelous in our eyes. Miraculously, James survives the fall unhurt. He's not even injured. Okay? Which, again, remember Satan's temptation to Jesus. Throw yourself down from here, and if you survive, people will believe you, right? James is thrown off, and he survives unhurt, right? So, more fanning the flame for the people. The Mishnah instructs, if a person does not die from the first fall, then they must take a boulder and drop it on his chest. There is an apocryphal work called the Second Apocalypse of James. So you have the book of Revelation. Well, there's two books of Revelation that are attributed to James. In the second one, it actually reflects this custom, says regarding James's death. And they decided to throw him down from the height, and they cast him down. He doesn't die. So they seized him and struck him as they dragged him upon the ground. They stretched him out and placed a stone on his abdomen. And they all placed their feet on him, meaning the whole community had to participate. You have erred. And they crushed him. Josephus records the fact that it was Annas, the younger, who gives the final death blow. And Josephus goes on to record, it was because of that act, Annas assassinating, that's Josephus' words, because of Annas assassinating James, that God destroyed the temple and leveled Jerusalem. That's Josephus. That's not Eusebius the Christian historian, Hegesippus the Christian historian. That's not apocryphal Christian works of literature. This is Josephus saying the reason God allowed the temple of the people to be destroyed and the city of Jerusalem to be laid to waste was because Annas murdered James the Righteous. All right, we will close it there in our discussion of James for this weekend, as I've got to shift and go preach a little bit. But we will meet next week, same time, same place. Where we'll continue to go in the Chronicles of the Apostles is we'll finish up looking at James and maybe a few other apostles of the period. But then I want to start looking at the Didache, a writing known as the Didache. Probably late first century, probably the first catechism, if you will, to use that terminology, of the Jesus community. What did that document look like? This was a document called the Teaching of the Apostles for the Nations. So this was the first document we have written outside of the New Testament that was written specifically, supposedly by the apostles, but it was written specifically for how would Jesus communities receive Gentiles and how would they worship, how would they do life together, how would they pray, what would they pray, what would they study, what would they do. It really describes the way of being. And this is easily 80 AD, if not earlier. All right. So it's very instructive. Very instructive, because you have a late first century idea just just 50 years after the resurrection, of what the Jesus community looks like as it goes global. So it's worth looking at when they talk about praying the Lord's Prayer three times a day. Well, why would it make that recommendation? Why three times a day, and why the Lord's Prayer? Or when they say, pray this before you eat and pray this after you eat, where were those prayers coming from? And why do you pray after you eat and so forth? So very informative. So we'll look at some of that. And then we'll probably start looking into some of the epistles again, because we're kind of following a timeline. So now we're getting into the mid-60s, 70s, and 80s. So the other epistles are filling out. And maybe I'll throw in randomly to keep you on your toes and keep you attending. We'll spend some time in Revelation randomly. All right? Just so you'll be wondering, is it this week he's going to talk about it? Is it this week? All right? But we'll talk about some of it. Or we'll start doing some of the pre-work that you have to do before you study Revelation. All right? So because that's coming up on the timeline, Revelation is. All right, so that's kind of where we're headed. Let's close with a blessing. Blessed are you, Lord God, who has given to us the gift of the Scriptures. Amen.